You're listening to B-Side, where musicians tell the story of what they do with their lives when they're not doing music. It's a brisk winter morning in upstate New York. Today I'm visiting the Ananda Ashram, a yoga retreat and spiritual center just over an hour outside New York City. I'm here to meet the Reverend Kim Leslie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming all this way.
Oh,
Reverend Kim hails from a long line of jazz musicians in England, and her own life's journey has been just as rich. Reverend Kim is first and foremost a musician, but she's also an ordained interfaith minister who spent 14 years ministering to addicts in rehab. She's one of the meditation leaders here at the ashram. Oh, and she's also a licensed real estate agent here in the Hudson Valley. But before Kim Leslie did all of that, this was her gig. That's the 1983 smash hit Come Back and Stay by Paul Young. The song topped the charts in countries around the world, but it just wouldn't be the same without those incredible backing vocals. The two vocalists responsible for those great backing vocals went by a rather unfortunate name, the Fabulous Wealthy Tarts. One of the singers was Maz Roberts, the other was the Reverend Kim Leslie. And this is her B-side.
When you said goodbye, I was trying to hide.
Reverend Kim Leslie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, it's wonderful to meet you.
You have such an amazing and interesting career, so many different facets of your life's journey. I want to get to from the music to the ministry work that we were talking about earlier, and to what we're doing here at this beautiful place, this beautiful ashram. I want to get to all of that, but I want to start in 1983.
Okay.
I keep hearing the song Come Back and Stay by Paul Young on the radio. For whatever reason, that song has just stood up the test of time. It's lasted this long. And it's a song that when I hear it, I don't think it works without what you did on the vocals. You and Maz make that song. Tell me how that song and how your role on that song came together.
That particular band was, in England at the time, extremely original and musically influential, even though we were a pop band. There was much more to it. So each musician in Paul Young's band had extra gifts, had other things that they could do as well. So a large part of my journey had been I've been classically taught. I used to kind of mess around with it, and I used to incorporate it into some of my jazz gigs and still do that sound, the operatic classical type of sound. But also, of course, I'm a complete lover of the blues. So when I would be singing around and messing around, or some of the band would come and see me perform with my own band, which was a bebop jazz band at the time, they would hear me sing in this bluesy operatic way. And the producer, Laurie Latham, and Paul himself, and also the Rev on keys, Ian, would ask me to see what it would sound like in the middle of this. And I said, whoa, what a great idea. And that's how it came about, that particular sound in that song.
Kim's success with Paul Young didn't happen overnight. She comes from a long line of musicians and started singing at a very young age.
I actually started as a solo singer when I was 12 and 13, and I joined the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, which is still going today.
Wow.
And did quite a few live gigs with them. I also did a lot of club dates at the time, where I was solo singing at the time. When I mean at the time, I mean at the age of 14 and 15, I started to sing the top 40 with different bands at weddings and things like that, that young. I started to sing jazz when I was 15 and 16 in my father's jazz octet. And he had a bebop jazz octet called the Alan Stewart Octet for 50 years with some of the greatest jazz musicians in England. So I was singing in his band as well as a teenager. Maz and I started up a cabaret act. And then also at the same time, when I was 17, at the same time, we then went on to a band called Panties. And we were really popular in England. It was at the same time as punk, but we were like a punk rock Latin band, and me and Maz were the lead singers. And then by the time I was about 20 years old, we were discovered by Jules Holland.
And he gave you and Maz a name that he says now he perhaps regrets having given you.
Well, actually, I don't think Jules regrets anything that he's ever done in his life. And if he says he does regret something, he's pulling your leg.
Fair enough.
He was very happy to give us that name, especially after I told him it was our first gig at Leeds. I told him that whatever he does, he must not call us any names detrimental to our musicality. I said, don't use the word tarts or slag or anything, because I know your sense of humor. Don't use any terrible word. And he said, I promise I will not. He said, I'll build you up and I'll think of a beautiful name in the moment. And me and Maz said, okay, fair enough. We went on stage, came to the moment where he was going to introduce us. And he said, I introduce to you the fabulous, wealthy. And me and Maz were smiling. Fabulous and wealthy sounds good.
Right.
And then he went, tarts, and we swore at him, but then of course had a good laugh about it because it was the greatest name ever because it was so ridiculous.
And how was it received by the audience that night?
Everybody cheered. Everybody completely cheered. It was like the whole place erupted just because of the name.
That's excellent. That's so great. Yeah, he says in his memoir, and like you said, he's probably pulling our leg, but mm-hmm. He says, with the benefit of hindsight, it may have been a mistake to call them the wealthy tarts. And he says the name seems to make people, or even then, made people uneasy.
Yeah, I mean, well, we were all about that, weren't we?
Weren't we?
That we were all about making people feel a bit uneasy. I don't know. I think sometimes the best lessons in life are going to make you a bit uneasy at first. But that name was really... Yeah, we had a right go at him afterwards and then laughed about it. So if he regrets it, it's new news to me. I've never heard him regret anything.
That was his memoir from 2008.
Yes, I did read that book.
And musically, was that was a rich time for you, I imagine.
We were a bit of a revolutionary band, as I said before, because the musicians in the band were so good and diverse and really schooled. Not schooled going to school, but schooled in how we all studied. We all studied the blues. We studied jazz. We studied rock. We studied punk. We studied everything we could get our hands on. We were absolutely immersed 24/7, all of us, before we all met. And what grew out of that band... And, you know, people know that. Other musicians know that. And, you know, the great bass player Pino Palladino came out of Jules Holland's band and then transferred into Paul Young's band as Maz and I did. We came out of Jules Holland's band and also transferred into Paul's band. So it was, and she married Pino.
Right.
So, and then there's the great Bolts on guitar and just amazing. And the Rev on organ, who's the closest thing to Billy Preston in England we ever had at the time. You know, since then, there's been some incredible musicians in England that have come out. I'm talking about diverse musicians, really open-minded, imbibing all of the English scene, but taking the roots from America. We knew our shit. Oh, I've sworn.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. And that's not a that's a familiar theme in English music, going back to the roots of R&B and blues, you know, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and so forth, studying and learning the what was happening in America and then putting its own kind of spin on things and doing making a completely new sound, but rooted in some of that stuff. So that I kind of see that tradition as something that has continued from the 60s onward, and you guys were an embodiment of that as well.
Well, I'm glad that you mention it, because not everybody knows, you know, not everybody realizes that the original study was the American blues player, and the original study is black music in America. That is the original study. Of course, you know, to be white and English, you do have all your own overtones of the divine Celt, you know, the Celtic music, the amazing folk music that we have throughout Europe. We have that in our soul, but we were all completely obsessed with American black music. As you say, so were the Rolling Stones, and first to admit it.
Sure.
And even the Beatles.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely the
Beatles. And even down to the Police, Reggaeton de Blanc, you know, it's black, sure. It's white reggae.
Definitely.
You know,
yeah,
and we all know it, The Clash, everybody. Exactly.
By the early 1990s, Kim had moved to America. She wanted to get closer to the music she loved.
What was behind that move? What brought you here?
It was a number of things. I had this wonderful band in England who actually ended up, the entire band, working with Tom Jones for years.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
It's almost like he stole my band. But I came over to write some new songs because I always wanted. I had toured with Jules Holland. I had toured with Paul Young in the States. And I'd always wanted to come back to stay for a while to really imbibe the soil here and to, you know, be qualified to sing the Billie Holiday songs that I'm always singing. However, I came here to write a few songs, which I did. I formed a band over here and played CBGBs and Bitter End and the China Club and never went home. It was absolutely the right thing to do.
I can imagine, as somebody who loves the blues and the jazz, this is where you'd want to be.
And American soul and funk music. That is like the huge part of me. And this is where it's at. I mean, it's so wonderful in England right now because people are doing it in it, but they weren't. I was one of the first people to do it in England, to do the crossover.
Right. So you come to New York, you eventually had your daughter, Jasmine,
mm-hmm.
who's also very musical.
Yes.
Jasmine was one of the original cast members of Hamilton.
Yep.
So clearly talent runs deep. It comes from your father. You said that this goes back 50 years and through the generations now to your daughter as well.
My mother was a singer. My grandmother was a singer.
This is in your blood.
And all my father's uncles were jazz musicians, trumpet players, drummers, piano players. It's just ridiculous. And my sister sings and my cousins sing and play. So, yeah, it's all over the place.
How did you get the Reverend in your name?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about what choices in your life led you to becoming an interfaith minister.
I had had, for up until the age of 30 years old, a drinking problem. And it was very functional. I was very, very, very functional within my use of alcohol. But coming to America, I discovered that I wanted to stop and I wanted to get into the 12-step rooms and see what life was like sober. So the honest answer to your question is, within the 12-step rooms and within my journey of going inwards and then coming to places like the ashram and meeting the guru here and just a series of spiritual events internally with meditation, I discovered that there was more than just the music. And then I realized that it was all a combination. It was all married to each other. I had an epiphany one evening and realized that I was being called to become a minister. And here's the story. I was working with Jenny Burton in Atlantic City. And the person that came on after us was the Reverend Al Green. And he came out And he is one of my favorite singers in the entire world.
Sure.
Completely. Him and Al Jarreau, the two Al's. And he came out and he turned Atlantic, this is what it was, he turned Atlantic City into a church. How do you do that? How do you turn a gambling hall into a church? And I watched it before my own eyes happen through his hits, but interspersing the gospel side of his belief. And he caught the Holy Spirit and he comes off stage with the Holy Spirit, comes down the stairs, and I had my backstage pass still on me because I'd just performed just before him. I ran down to where he was coming off the stage because I wanted to catch the Holy Spirit off of him. And there's nobody around him. So he's not doing it for anybody. There he was, immersed in the Holy Spirit, walking and grooving along the corridor, singing to God by himself.
Wow.
And I ran up behind him and just started to sing with him and started to just pray with him. And he swung around and he looked at me and he said, "You know what you have to do." And I came away from that experience with, what is it that I have to do? And it came to me that I have to become ordained, become a minister. That was the main moment. That was just before the Twin Towers went down. I was ordained at St. John the Divine in Manhattan. And as soon as I was ordained, the towers came down. And that was my first assignment. So it was like being thrown in completely at the deep end and hanging in there for dear life for it and counseling hundreds of people that were displaced and homeless, and which led me to 14 years of running a spiritual program in rehabs. I invented the program. I used music and I used sound therapy and I used counseling skills and ran counseling services out of my home for years. About 20 years.
And how did you incorporate the music piece of that?
I got into kirtan, which is the call and response from India or any chanting in the world. Which is universal sound, musicians, tribal, and cuts through everything, singing the names of the holy names. And I used to bring musicians into the rehab and I used to run services, and a lot of it was spontaneous. I would make stuff up on the spot.
That's sometimes how the best stuff comes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And make music up on the spot, make songs up on the spot, but you know, chants up on the spot.
But also very consistent with the jazz tradition of improvisation.
Exactly. I always say that people say, "How do you do that?" And I say, "Well, it's just like making a jazz solo." That's exactly the right analogy of it. Yes.
So tell me about this wonderful ashram, Ananda Ashram, where we are now. You do meditation here. How did you get involved?
I came here about 26 years ago when the guru was still alive. And 3 weeks after I met him, he passed away. They call it Mahasamadhi. And the first moment that I walked in, he kept asking me to get up and sing in all the middle of the meditations and programs that he was running. And it was really profound meeting him. His energy is here 24/7. He is the guru for creativity. He's for many things and the master of Sanskrit. And I came here 26 years ago, and I've been coming here many times a year as much as I possibly could because I brought Jasmine up in Brooklyn. And then I decided to move near the ashram about 5 years ago. And it was different stages of actually buying a little house on top of a mountain, which is about 20 minutes from here. But it was a series of decisions that I made, but that was the focus, to stay and be close. This ashram is for everybody. It's for you. It's the artist's ashram. It's the scholar's ashram. And it is so close to Manhattan. It's only an hour and 15 minutes away. And people come here on yoga retreats, on sound healing retreats. They come here for concerts. It's just so much of a loving, giving space. And we're still here.
And you've performed here on numerous
occasions. Yes, I've done concerts here every year, and I've led kirtan here many times. And in the last few years, I lead fire ceremony, especially on Friday mornings. I can't imagine life without this space. This is my church.
Sure.
You know, I go out and do church for others, but this is mine. This is my temple.
No, it's a very warm and welcoming place, and you can really feel that when you're here. You also have another component to your life in real estate.
Yes.
So you came here and you fell in love with, I mean, this is undoubtedly a beautiful part of the world.
Yes.
And so how did the real estate thing come together for you?
Well, it's another manifestation of my own spiritual life. In order for me to buy a little house up here, in order for me to stay up here and to stop working in Manhattan, you know, on a daily basis. And I'd done 14 years in the rehabs, and I felt like it was time for me to stop and to just enjoy the countryside more, which is where I really want to be. And so in order for me to do that, I was thinking, well, what could I do that I could make some money at, that I could be my own boss at, that I could get in my car and drive around the countryside and also help people find homes? And I've always done that all my life. I've always helped people find homes to live in.
The physical homes and spiritual homes.
Yes. It kind of just popped. I'm the person I bought my house off, who is a real estate agent up here and a good friend of mine. She suggested it. And I said, what an amazing thought. And I just went ahead and got my license and started to do it and started to earn money at it. And it's allowing me to stay up here right now. Mm. And live in the countryside.
And do your clients ever know that other side, that musical side of you?
Yes.
They do?
They do. Some people are very inquisitive about it, and then others don't really want to know about it because they don't want to imagine that I'm interested in anything else but real estate. And of course, you know, real estate is over here because the music is right here, you know.
Right.
The music is my heart and always will be. But that income, when I say that, that means the ministry too. That there's no separation. It's all one.
That oneness Kim speaks of, the unity of the music and the spirituality, is front and center on her 2003 album, Daughter of God. On that record, she blends R&B, funk, jazz, and bebop with kirtan and Indian motifs.
Is timeless. I'm very proud of it, and it has beautiful musicians on it of all different backgrounds, whether they come from spiritual backgrounds or whether they come straight out of the jazz bebop situation. A mixture of people and a mixture of different types of music. It's deeply spiritual, and at the very same time it's really funky and very jazzy and very innovative in a way. I actually do a scat solo over a tabla solo. So the two of us are battling it out. I mean, there's all sorts of different things on this album that's quite interesting to a lot of different people.
And you're planning a second one this year?
I am, yes.
As music has been such a part of your entire life and every facet of your life, what do you single out, if you could single out, the proudest achievement musically for you?
I think the proudest thing I am, for all the things that I've done, and I think the songwriting is something that I'm really proud of. All my songs are like children, and they've given a lot to people. And I'm very proud of that. And I'm also proud of my ability to dig deep into the real root of every type of music and find out where it's come from. Not all musicians can feel that. They might know it. But then there's a pilgrimage on seeking it out to even be qualified to even enter the realm of where it might come from. And there has to be an enormous amount of understanding and respect. The only way that I could really do that and I am proud of this, is leave the country that I was born in and come to the country that I feel most comfortable in musically.
That's a great answer. Because for me, when I was in Manchester, I was like, oh, if only I could leave this country and go here, where musicians and the stuff that I've always loved has just been revered. It's just, you know, it's put up on a pedestal in that city.
Absolutely.
It's I don't find that here, but that's neither here nor there. That's just.
But let me tell you something about Manchester.
Please.
Manchester was the first town to invite Wilson Pickett, to invite James Brown, Otis Redding. London rejected them at first. It was not London that brought them over. It was Manchester. That's why it's called the Soul City, is because they claim that they were the first people that really imbibed American soul funk music and brought it over from the States, invited them over.
Yeah, that's clear with the musical history that city has. You can hear that in so much. But that's something that Londoners probably don't want to hear about.
Well, London's full of many different people, including myself at one time.
But you're here now. We claim you as one of us in this country. Reverend Kim Leslie, thank you so much. You have an amazing, amazing story, and thank you for sharing it with us today.
You are so very welcome, and bless you, and thank you so much for coming to the ashram.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to the Reverend Kim Leslie, minister, meditation leader, real estate agent, and of course, musician. And look for her new album this year. I'm Court Harson. Thanks for listening, and join me again next time for another edition of B-Side.